RIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Christians in the occupied Palestinian territories face the threat of extinction from radical Israeli groups, church leaders have warned in a startling message in the run-up to Christmas. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by the staff of Electronic Intifada. This article is titled Palestinian Christians Face Threat of Extinction from Radical Israeli Groups. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Christians in the occupied Palestinian territories face the threat of extinction from radical Israeli groups. Church leaders have warned in a startling message in the run-up to Christmas. They have called for help from the worldwide Christian community of 2.3 billion people. In recent years, the lives of many Christians have been made unbearable by radical local groups with extremist ideologies, said Francisco Patton, the Catholic Church's custos of the Holy Land. Writing in the Daily Telegraph, he warned of the threat from Israeli extremists. Despite 2,000 years of faithful service, our presence is precarious and our future is at risk. Patton is also the guardian of the Christian religious sites in the Holy Land. He pointed out, where once we numbered 20% of the population of Al-Quds, today the Christian community counts for less than 2%. Prior to the creation of the fake regime of Israel in 1948, Palestinian Christians were the second largest religious community, making up more than 11% of the total population. The waves of ethnic cleansing, which the Palestinians call the Nakba or catastrophe, have reduced their number to its present extinction level. The Zionist regime's violent capture, illegal annexation and military occupation of Al-Quds has accelerated the flight of Palestinian Christians from their country. Human rights groups have described the Zionist regime's rule over the territory as a form of apartheid, under which Christian Palestinians are also treated like second and third class citizens. Patton explained that the lives of Christians have been made unbearable because radical Jewish groups seek to free the old city of Al-Quds from its Christian presence, even the Christian quarter. The targeting of Palestinian Christians has increased at an alarming rate. In the last years, we suffered because of the desecration of our holy sites, the vandalization of our churches, offenses against our priests, monks, and worshippers, he said. The frequency of these hate crimes leaves families and communities who lived here for generations feeling unwelcome in their own homes. Patton said that the radical Israeli groups are waging a war of attrition against a community before urging the global Christian community to aid Palestinian Christians facing the threat of extinction. A similar message was delivered by Bishop of Canterbury Justin Welby in an article for The Times co-authored with the Anglican Bishop of Al-Quds Hossam Naum. In remarks that should ring alarm bells across the Christian world, the two leaders said that when you speak to Palestinian Christians in Al-Quds today, you will often hear them saying, in 15 years' time, there will be none of us left, calling for followers to pray for the Christians being driven from the Holy Land. Welby and Naum warned that in the birthplace of the church, worshippers are dwindling in the face of intimidation and discrimination by Zionists. Details of a joint statement by church leaders were mentioned in a Times piece, including the sustained attacks by fringe radical groups against Christians and countless physical and verbal assaults against priests and other clergy and Christian churches. The bishops added that the growth of Israeli settler communities and travel restrictions brought about by the West Bank separation wall have deepened the isolation of Christian villages and curtailed economic and social possibilities. The remarks by the church leaders triggered a backlash from the Board of Deputies of British Jews, which has called for a meeting with the Bishop of Canterbury to discuss what they describe as deeply troubling passages in the Times article.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
There is rising anger in West Africa region over continued French military presence. Now, recently, angry masses in Burkina Faso and Niger attempted to stop a French military convoy heading to Mali. Here is one of the protesters in Burkina Faso.
France has to leave, together with its weapons. That's it. That's what we want. We don't need the French army.
Hello and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. Today, we are focusing on an upsurge of protests by West Africans who are demanding the complete withdrawal of French forces in the region. They say that despite the presence of these French troops, the region has seen increased attacks by Takfiri terrorists. Some people actually believe that French forces are supporting these terrorists in the region. Now, in the second part of our program, we shall talk about mixed-race women who are taken away from their Congolese mothers in infancy during colonial rule by Belgium. Now, these women have sued the Belgian state for committing a crime against humanity. So stay with us as our experts give us incisive analysis on these two issues.
West Africans reject French forces. Anger continues to boil over in the West Africa region over continued French military presence in its former colonies. Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger are former French colonies where the struggle against France's presence in the Sahel region of Africa has been most intense. Last November, there were protests against a French military convoy that was moving from the Ivory Coast to Gao in Mali, passing through Burkina Faso and Niger.
Now, the masses in this region have come out to protest against the presence of French troops in what is seen as new resistance against imperialist forces in the region. People protesting against French military forces in Burkina Faso are also suspicious about the cargo ferried by French military convoys.
What do they carry? What do they take with them every time that they leave for the Sahel? What we want today is that they're not going to pass. Even if we're going to spend 2 months here, we're set. We're not going to move. We don't want to negotiate. We're not asking for anything. What we're asking is just one thing. They can go home.
Well, now, for more on this, my colleague contacted Nefta Freeman, a coordinating committee member of the Black Alliance for Peace. Now, we first asked Mr. Freeman the reasons for renewed resistance against French neo-colonialism in the Sahel region of West Africa.
I think the reasons for the renewed resistance are that the people are, there's a number of reasons. One, the people are frustrated with neocolonialism, frustrated with the fact that neocolonialism prohibits them from having governments that are responsive to their basic needs, that their the resources in their country and that the markets and that their labor are being exploited ever since colonialism, just new forms of colonialism, for the interest of foreigners and the Western powers. There's also a sense and an understanding that French neocolonialism is on its last leg, just like neocolonialism in general is on its last leg. We can even see, I'm sure that our people in Africa and the Sahel and other places also see the destabilization of French colonialism in the Caribbean, in Martinique and Guadeloupe. And so these things inspire people. We've seen that in history where the weaknesses, certain weaknesses identified in colonialism give inspiration to others who are colonized under those same empires. So, and then even inside France itself.
While France has created media hype around the withdrawal of its forces in some parts of West Africa, it has actually expanded its main Sahel military base in the northern Mali city of Gao. The French army supply, which arrived in Africa in Ivory Coast last November, passed Burkina Faso and Niger before making it to the Gao military base. So what is the importance of this French military base in Gao?
Well, the French military base in Gao, Mali, was established first, I'm not sure, but the establishment was in the early 2000s, like 2011 or 13 or something, under the auspices of trying to fight terrorism. And so these are the same reason for U.S. military bases all over. France and the U.S. are serious about militarization of the continent of Africa. And this is the only thing that they have to maintain their dominance and hegemony on the continent of Africa, where they're seeing an increased Cold War with China, which China's methods of exerting their influence and finding and exercising their interests is through economic means. And actually a means that is helping build infrastructure. France and the U.S. don't have that same thing.
Now, masses protesting against the presence of French troops in West Africa are also suspicious that these foreign troops are secretly supplying weapons to Takfiri terrorist groups that threaten the region's security. Now, we asked Mr. Freeman to give us his take on reports by locals that French troops have been carrying weapons for Takfiri terrorist groups in the Sahel region of West Africa.
I think the local people in Burkina Faso and Niger have a very legitimate concern in terms of the presence of the suspicions around the convoy and the fact that, I mean, it's not beneath these forces, France and even the U.S., to play both sides against the middle in order to justify or pursue their own interest. And the fact that terrorism has persisted in spite of them saying that their presence is there to curtail terrorism. In fact, it's increased. Well, studies have been done. And it makes sense that it would increase because of the anxiety people feel and the animosity people feel of having to experience the type of violence that they're experiencing, even at the hands of the Western powers that claim they're trying to fight terrorism.
The Sahel region is rich in mineral resources such as uranium, gold, and oil, and citizens in these countries believe France is supporting terrorists to justify its continued presence in the region with the specific objective of plundering these resources.
We also asked Mr. Freeman if the masses are justified in believing that French forces are in West Africa to continue looting the region's natural resources.
The people of those regions not only have legitimate concerns and their opinions are justified, they've actually even seen it. If we just look at the history of Mali, for example, a concrete example is that they started off at some point supporting the separatist movement, the Tuareg separatist movement, calling for independence in northern Mali. That was against the government in Mali. The National Movements for Liberation of Azawadi is what they supported. Then they turned around, you know, because of the claims of, you know, other Western powers professing that they're trying to fight terrorism, and they switched sides. And during that time, the French government is known to even support work with the corrupt governments in the interest of securing their interests around these very resources.
The anti-France sentiments in Burkina Faso have further been fueled by anger amid the trial of several people accused of assassinating the country's former president, Thomas Sankara.
The inquiry into Sankara's murder established that French agents were present in Burkina Faso the day after the assassination to destroy incriminating information on those involved. Sankara gained fame because of his popular anti-imperialist stances. Why do the people in Burkina Faso believe that Sankara was eliminated in a conspiracy backed by neo-colonial powers?
You know, the history, you know, is a very informative thing. And then when you talk about those countries that were under French colonialism, the people, especially this newer generation, it's widely known about Patrice Lumumba. It's widely known that imperialists were involved with the assassination of Patrice Lumumba. They actually orchestrated this. And that we also know that the stand that Thomas Sankara took, and particularly the United Nations, and talking about using the resources of the African continent for the African people, and that, you know, just really calling out, so to speak, French imperialism and other imperialism on the continent of Africa, and then actually embarking on a path of a socialism and using the resources of Burkina Faso for the people and sort of democratic processes, that you know, colonists don't stand for that. It interrupts their interest. And so we've seen throughout history where they will assassinate people, they will invade, they will do whatever to turn that back. So it's a quite legitimate suspicion to have.
Malians have also taken to the streets of Bamako to demonstrate against the French military presence in Mali, calling for the total withdrawal of French troops from the country.
We are here for Mali. We are here to demonstrate our national sovereignty. Remind the whole world that sovereignty belongs to the people, and that those who have not understood this must get up to speed today, because the transition for us today is a result of decades of mismanagement, misgovernance of our country, and bad partnership.
These sporadic anti-France protests continue to rock various parts of West Africa. We asked Mr. Freeman if the mass demonstrations affect France's continued presence in the Sahel.
There's no way it can't affect it, but how will it affect it remains to be seen. Unfortunately, the reactionary nature of imperialism is to, they see their intent on continue in their dominance. And so the protests make them increase their repression. But at the same time, if as the protests become and the people become more organized and then sophisticated in their opposition, they could actually see some gains in pushing in colonialism back and forcing other players on the international scene to call out and support their just struggle. So I think it will have impact.
Well, there you have it. Mr. Freeman says if protesters become more organized and sophisticated, then they can eventually compel French forces to exit the region. We now take a short break, and when we come back, we shall talk about the move by several women to take Belgium to court over some of the crimes it committed in the Congo during colonial rule. Stay with us.
Women sue Belgium over Congo war crimes.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Five mixed-race women born in Congo while under Belgian colonial rule have taken the former brutal colonial power to court. The women accused the Belgian state of crimes against humanity, insisting that they were taken away from their black mothers and separated from their African roots.
As expected, early December, these women lost the first round of their case in the Belgium court. They had hoped Belgium would recognize responsibility for the suffering of thousands of mixed-race children. Lawyers and relatives now say that they will appeal the Brussels court's ruling. The five women, all born between 1945 and 1950, filed their lawsuit last year amid growing demands that Belgium reassesses its colonial past. They still hope that the cases will be concluded during their lifetime.
Now, for more analysis on this subject, we contacted Julius Mbaluto, an African affairs analyst. Mr. Mbaluto first explains about the merits of the case brought up by these mixed-race women.
There is a lot of merit in this case. And why do I say so? Because they are right dealing with the issues. They have brought it to the fore. And they have support, of course, by United Nations, which is a good thing. I guess it was the pressure from United Nations in 2019 that made the Prime Minister of Belgium, Michael Charles, to apologize. And of course, we also saw the Catholic Church apologizing. So probably then we are talking about a reparation. We're talking about their compensation for the atrocities committed to them. And I do think the world will be behind them. I feel there's a lot of support on their case. Because, you know, we are talking about injustices. We are talking about killings of people. We are talking about discrimination of the highest level.
The women are demanding answers from the Belgian state on why they were snatched from their families and why they were made to suffer. They are asking for reparations for lives that were broken apart. These women, who are now grandmothers themselves, hope for the start of a new chapter and to resolve decades of trauma. One of the victims speaks here on their traumatic experience.
C'est une souffrance.
It's painful to reflect on. It was inhumane.
I put myself back into the shoes of a tiny child who is searching for her mother. At two, you need your mother, her smell and her warmth, but there was none of that. There was just people around you you didn't recognize, didn't understand.
We asked Mr. Mbaluto about the emotional and psychological state of those who were kidnapped by Belgian colonial forces.
According to Belgian law, intermarriage between different races, especially blacks and also the whites in Democratic Republic of Congo, was illegal. And that being illegal, all children who were born out of mixed race, they were given names which were not nice names. When you call them Métis in French, or you call them mulatto, mulatto was the worst one because it was equating those children with animals. And therefore, you can imagine if someone comes to you today, they just say you are valued, you just equal like an animal. It's just not nice. And I can imagine when children don't forget stuff that easily, for them to go through that psychologically, it was a trauma. It was a trauma. And another thing is that the moment what we see happening, they were segregated, also separated from, you know, like the rest of the community.
Now, the women's lawyers said they were aged between 2 and 4 when they were taken away following orders by the Belgian colonial administration in collaboration with the local Catholic Church authorities. Mr. Mbaluto elaborates here on the role the Catholic Church played in the kidnappings of African mixed-race children from Congo during the colonial rule by Belgium.
The Catholic Church is not apologizing for nothing because it was partner to the colonial government. What used to happen was the system, government system, that disallowed marriage between different races. Of course, for their own reason, they wanted to see not to be seen as equal with those whom they colonized. And therefore, that narrative, the collusion between the colonial government of Belgium and Catholic Church, will see it that the children have been kidnapped. They will be kept within the Catholic Church. And it was actually the Catholic Church that facilitated their journey to Belgium. And also, those in there, they were kept sent to orphanages through the Catholic Church as well.
The Belgian government issued what it called an apology for the role played by the colonial regime in taking thousands of young children away from their African mothers.
On behalf of the Belgian federal government, I apologize for the Métis of Belgian colonial origin and their families for the injustice and their suffering.
Is this so-called apology enough?
It's not enough. The sad news, let's put it this way, even away from even the apology by the Catholic Church or even the Prime Minister, even if you give them money, even if it was millions, it can never be enough. See, it wouldn't bring back wonderful life experiences of living in a normal family, which was denied to these people. For children, it won't bring the joy of being a child and growing up seeing your parents from 4 years to 70. It won't bring back that. It won't bring back your position as a child and growing up in a neighborhood you are loved and you feel you are equal to your playmates. That it won't bring back all that.
This issue of kidnappings is just a tip of the iceberg because many other atrocities were committed during the Belgian colonial rule in Congo. From 1885 to 1908, King Leopold's brutal colonial rule saw nearly 10 million Congolese killed. Thousands had hands chopped off by his military because they had failed to deliver the harsh quotas of rubber that the colonialists demanded.
Now, is it about time to open the files of crimes perpetrated by Belgium, especially regarding the genocide of millions of Congolese people? Here is Mr. Mbaluto's take.
When King Leopold ruled Congo from 1908 a lot of atrocities were committed. I think the estimation I've read in the past is close to 10 million people were killed. And you see, when you talk about the kidnappings of the children, it's just a drop in the ocean. You can begin to look into all these societies in the bigger picture of the crimes against humanity, the killings of millions of people, and also the way everyone else was treated. You know, our typical description of colonialism is pretty ruthless, unkind, brutal, unfair, unjust. There are many, I lack names to just keep on describing it. That's what it is, and it was brutal.
Well, Mr. Mbaluto there says no words are enough to describe the brutality meted out to Africans by colonial forces. Unfortunately, our time is up for today. But here at Africa Today, we shall continue highlighting the crimes committed by colonialists against the people of Africa. Well, that wraps it up for this week's edition of Africa Today. We hope you enjoyed the show. It will be great hearing from you, so send us your comments through our social media handle. Goodbye for now, and God bless you.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Russia, Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
As millions of Yemenis face the threat of drowning into a famine due to the ongoing Saudi-led war on the country, the World Food Programme says it will reduce its food rations to 8 million people in Yemen starting next month due to a lack of funding.
What the World Food Programme has done is a clear escalation against civilians and will primarily harm children and women who depend on humanitarian aid for their survival. The United Nations bears full responsibility because it's primarily responsible for humanitarian aid and it's supposed to protect civilians, not help international political forces to impose pressure on Yemenis.
The United Nations warned that the shortage of funds will hamper the assistance it provides to 13 million Yemenis, including thousands of children suffering from acute malnutrition.
The announcement by the World Food Programme to reduce food aid provided to 8 million people is to continue to blackmail the Yemeni people and the political leadership and pressure them to yield more and make more concessions in favor of the coalition of aggression. And unfortunately, the international community is complicit in this aggression. This act will cause a major humanitarian catastrophe since the aid reaches only a very small number of people and most of the money earned by international organizations goes to operate expenses of the organizations themselves and not to the needy.
Since the beginning of the Saudi-led war on Yemen in 2015, millions of Yemenis have been depending on humanitarian assistance to survive. The United Nations describes Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
Observers say the lives of millions of Yemenis remain in danger unless the international community takes real measures to pressure Saudi Arabia to lift the siege it imposes on Yemen. Despite ongoing humanitarian assistance, the world body says 16.2 million people in Yemen remain food insecure. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
President Vladimir Putin has talked about Moscow's security proposals presented to the NATO alliance last week. Speaking during his annual press conference, he said it is the Western countries that must immediately give Russia security guarantees, not the other way around.
They told us in the 1990s, not an inch to the east. What is the result? They cheated us. They simply impudently cheated us with NATO's five waves of expansion. Now the corresponding systems are already appearing in Romania and Poland. Have we approached the borders of the US or Britain? They have approached ours, and now they say Ukraine will also be a NATO member.
Prominent Russian journalists who have worked in the presidential pool for 20 years believe that Putin's statements serve as a deterrent against the West.
It seems to me that he should not be fascinated by anything for a long time, but he himself sets the vector of many agreements, follows a path that is sometimes completely unexpected for many, hinting that if it is ignored, then retaliatory actions will follow. And since no one knows what they can be, they start to get scared. This is a deterrent.
Speaking about Ukraine, Putin said that Russia was responding to threats from Kyiv. He said Kyiv does not want to honor the Minsk agreements and adopts laws that run counter to these accords. Putin said Ukraine and the West want to portray Russia as a party of the conflict in that country. He said incumbent Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky has been under the influence of radical elements after coming to power, like the country's previous leaders.
There must be tension for the hegemon to change. The hegemon, which is America and the English-speaking world, will not just give itself up. But this hegemon does not have enough strength, and we are watching it trying to enter into negotiations.
On Afghanistan, Putin stated that Afghanistan needs a government that represents its entire people so it can be recognized by the international community. He asserted that the countries that occupied Afghanistan for two decades should be the first to offer aid. He called on the West to unfreeze Afghanistan's financial assets, warning that the country is on the brink of famine.
Putin holds a big press conference every year in December, during which the president often touches on acute international problems and suggests ways to solve them. The statements made by the Russian president during this event are prompted by politicians from different countries, in particular by the opponents of Russia. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
ratio of Iranian military might and Israeli saber-rattling, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps fired 16 ballistic missiles in a fitting conclusion to its latest exercises. The IRGC confirmed that the missile hit and destroyed their intended targets with 100% accuracy. Five-day drills, dubbed Great Prophet 17, also featured a variety of combat and reconnaissance drones, sophisticated ballistic and cruise missiles, and attack helicopters. Advanced homegrown tank, dubbed Karar, also debuted in the exercises. The joint maneuvers involved IRGC's ground, naval, and aerospace divisions and spanned over Iran's southern coastline almost entirely, including Hormozgan, Bushehr, and Khuzestan provinces. The Persian Gulf and the Strait of Hormuz provided the maritime setting for Iranian forces to show their might. Iran regularly holds military exercises to maintain its combat readiness and deter any act of aggression. It says the maneuvers carry a message of peace and security for its neighbors and friendly countries. But this time around, the drills carried greater significance amid escalating anti-Iran rhetoric by Israel. The IRGC chief did not mince his words, describing the exercises as an authentic warning to Israel.
These maneuvers, particularly today's exercises, carried a very clear and explicit message, and that's a serious, real, and battlefield warning to the Zionist regime's officials, who have repeatedly issued anti-Iran threats, to beware of their mistakes and errors. In case of a misstep by them, we will cut off their hands.
General Salami stressed that all it takes to turn the drills into an actual military campaign is readjusting the direction the missiles are fired in. Israel and its main backer, the U.S., have repeatedly and overtly in recent weeks warned of a military offensive against the Islamic Republic, despite the ongoing talks in Vienna to revive the 2015 Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action after the U.S. unilateral withdrawal, with Israeli President Isaac Herzog saying that Iran's nuclear program must be neutralized once and for all, with or without an agreement. It's widely believed that such threats lack credibility and serve as a mere leverage to extract concessions from Iran around the negotiating table. The Iranian negotiators, however, can confidently and nonchalantly stand their ground with such display of military prowess and deterrence backing them up.
Visiting Afghanistan's largest children's hospital in Kabul. These days, the hospital is receiving malnourished babies more than any time before. Doctors here say malnutrition has increased since the poverty is on the rise in Afghanistan, adding the hospital lacks beds and medicines.
The patients in our malnutrition wards have recently increased. There aren't enough rooms for them. Sometimes we have to place more than one patient on an individual bed. If the ongoing shortage of food and nutrition continues, more and more children will face malnutrition.
World countries should help Afghan malnourished mothers and children. It's obvious to all what's going on in Afghanistan. Our breadwinners are jobless as winter bites. Children and mothers are being malnourished as food is not brought to table.
According to UNICEF, 3.2 million children under the age of 5 are expected to suffer from acute malnutrition by the end of the year. Authorities say world countries should not leave Afghan children alone.
Definitely, our hospital has been suffering from bad impacts of U.S. sanctions. The U.S. has seized what belongs to Afghan innocent people, and it is a cruel attempt. I demand the international community to send their humanitarian aid to Afghan people today as they used to help our nation under the previous government.
Following the Taliban took over of the country, international funding to the Afghan people were cut off and billions of dollars in Afghan assets were frozen by the U.S. The war may be over in Afghanistan, but the nation now is struggling with an economic crisis. Half of the population of Afghanistan is facing acute hunger, and over 1 million Afghan children are at risk of dying. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Turkish lira gained 20% on Monday following a speech by President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. The recovery followed a series of decisions announced by the president in a presser after the cabinet meeting. He said the new measures will encourage Turks to keep their savings in local currency instead of exchanging it to US dollar and euro.
We are presenting a new financial alternative to citizens who want to alleviate their concerns stemming from the rise in exchange rates when they evaluate their savings. Investors will be encouraged to move towards Turkish lira-based assets by issuance of government bills that are indexed to public economic enterprise revenues that are transferred to the budget.
Erdogan also said the Turkish government will help exporters who find it difficult to present the prices and foreign exchange rates due to fluctuation. He said that the government goes ahead with its lower interest rates plan as promised. The Turkish lira was at 18.4 against the US dollar before the president's speech and stood at 11.3 after it. The lira gaining value rapidly forced people to exchange the US dollar they had into Turkish lira in fear that the rate will go further down. However, the lira lost some of this value Tuesday morning and stood at 13.4 against the US dollar. No one here expected Erdogan's speech to have such an impact. Despite the wild swings, the lira is still down more than 40% against the dollar year to date. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres landed in Beirut on Sunday to follow up several issues, including Lebanon's economic crisis. In a press conference, he described as saddening and heartbreaking the situation in Lebanon.
I am also gravely concerned about the impact of the economic and financial crisis in the country, causing ever more people to need humanitarian assistance. Yesterday, I visited Tripoli in North Lebanon, and today Tyre in the south. And I was very moved when listening to first-hand testimonies of how the crisis is impacting people's daily lives.
During his visit, the United Nations chief met President Michel Aoun and stressed that the United Nations stands in solidarity with Lebanon in its crisis. After meeting with Speaker Nabih Berri, the head of the UN recognized the Israeli violations of Lebanon's airspace.
The opportunity to discuss the presence of UNIFIL in southern Lebanon, the need to end with all violations of the ceasefire, and in particular, the speaker has drawn my attention to the violations of the airspace of Lebanon, and also the need for total implementation of the resolutions of the Security Council.
The UN chief called on the Lebanese political leaders to show unity in order to carry out fundamental reforms and continue talks with the International Monetary Fund. Analysts question whether the UN can have any tangible impact on the situation in Lebanon in light of U.S. sanctions and Israeli violations.
The question we need to ask today is, can the UN change the reality on the ground, especially since there are U.S. economic sanctions and there are daily Israeli violations against Lebanon? Up until now, we have not seen any practical measures from the UN to at least stop these violations and the injustice which the Lebanese people are subject to because of its support for the resistance and its fight to have full sovereignty over its country.
Guterres also visited Prime Minister Najib Mikati and lauded Lebanon's generosity in being a place where Syrians and Palestinians took refuge. The United Nations chief urged the international community to provide more financial assistance to Lebanon, which is grappling with a myriad of crises, especially an unprecedented economic collapse. Yet most Lebanese doubt that these words would be translated into measures to stop U.S. sanctions against Lebanon. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
In recent weeks, tensions between Russia on one side and Ukraine and the US and NATO on the other have reached an alarming new level, raising fears of an armed conflict. The two sides have time and time again accused each other of provoking a military escalation in Ukraine and warned of serious consequences. In the latest development, the Russian president has blamed the West for escalating tensions in Europe, citing NATO's eastward expansion and the U.S. withdrawal from missile treaties like the 1987 Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty and the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty. The Russian leader has also warned that his country is prepared to take military technical measures in response to unfriendly Western actions over Ukraine.
Russia stands for equal and indivisible security throughout the Eurasian area. Of course, as I have already noted, If our Western colleagues continue their aggressive course of action, we will take adequate military and technical actions in response. We will react toughly to unfriendly steps. And I want to emphasize, we have every right to do so. We have every right to take actions aimed at ensuring the security and sovereignty of Russia.
The warning comes as the US and its European allies have stepped up their anti-Russia rhetoric under the pretext that Moscow is building up its troops to invade Ukraine. Russia argues that it's the US and NATO that are infringing upon it with an eastward expansion and by arming Ukraine under false excuses. Russia has also demanded legal security guarantees regarding the situation around Ukraine. In the draft security pacts published on Friday, Russia urged NATO to give up any military activity in Eastern Europe and Ukraine and roll back the deployment of its troops and weapons. However, many experts have cast doubt on the possibility of reaching an agreement between the US and Russia, saying even if Washington accepts such terms, there is still no guarantee that it remains committed to them.
If we look at it contemporarily, US promises and guarantees and even signed treaties and negotiations mean nothing. I mean, Iran knows this with the JCPOA, the different nuclear treaties which have been violated by the United States unilaterally. So these are worthless, and I doubt that they will actually make any agreement.
The United States, especially under the presidency of Joe Biden, has made its best efforts to provide military support to Ukraine, which lies on Russia's doorstep. In September, Washington signed a new cooperation agreement in the field of defense and security with Kiev. In the meantime, the U.S. is training military personnel in the Eastern European country, upgrading the country's ports to fit its warships and supplying it annually with hundreds of millions of dollars in military aid. The Biden administration's policies show that Washington is trying to keep tensions escalating to reduce Russia's influence in Eastern Europe, and Ukraine seems to be the best place to aim this goal. Russia, on the other hand, argues that while Ukraine is free to decide the security arrangements, those cannot threaten Russia's interests and security, insisting that Ukraine joining the NATO military alliance would cross a red line. As tensions between Russia and NATO over Ukraine are escalating, there are serious concerns about the potential for military escalation, potentially to the point of full-blown war.
Divine verses are recited by the most euphonious voices, and the best recitations will win the award of the 44th Quran competition in Iran. 200 contestants are competing in the Quranic event in two sections of female and male competitions and in seven different fields, including recitation, memorization, and interpretation.
Last year, the competition was held online due to pandemic. I'm so happy that this year is being held physically. I'm competing in recitation section and I hope I will win the contest.
The Holy Quran was revealed to Prophet Muhammad some 14 centuries ago to teach humanity how to live in peace. It preaches us against any kind of discrimination and intolerance. So it's good to recite the Quran with a beautiful voice and win a prize here in this contest. But at the same time, we need to pay attention to the divine instructions in order to benefit from this holy book.
The event is organized by the Endowment and Charity Affairs Organization. It says one of the major goals of this competition is to encourage the youth to keep their touch with the holy book of Quran at a time when technology has distracted societies from religious teachings.
The average age of the participants in the contest is below 30 years. This is very promising and shows that previous editions of the competition have been successful in attracting the youth and teens to the Holy Quran and its rich instructions.
The Quranic contest is held at a national scale, but at the same time, it's a preparatory stage for the International Quran Competition, which will be held next year in Iran, where finalists of this event will compete with international contestants.
Every Muslim family has the Holy Quran in their houses to read its verses and ponder its divine messages to mankind. Messages that can leave a deeper impact on listeners through these melodious recitations. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The sights and smells of home, from Palestinian traditional clothes to signature Palestinian dishes. Roughly 6 million Palestinians live in exile after 73 years of illegal Israeli occupation, which denies them the right to return.
Events like this bring together Palestinians from all walks of life, but the main target is the younger generation.
It's very important to bring my children to an event like this, to learn more about Palestine, about the struggle of the Palestinian people. Myself, I was born in a refugee camp in the Gaza Strip. They were born in Britain. They probably have no connection with Palestine whatsoever. So it's very important that we bring our kids to these events to learn more about the struggle of their own people.
The public isn't really educated about the occupation that's going on in Palestine. And they kind of think just because it's going on for so long that it's something that's normal and dismissed. Whereas events like this show us that it's not normal and we should fight for what we believe in.
It can never be just about art and culture. The festival, like the ones before, was also unapologetically political. The organizers called once again on the international community to end the occupation of Palestine. Former leader of the Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn, was there to offer his support as well.
Nobody ever chooses to be a refugee. Nobody ever wants to leave their home, their community, their family, their place of birth, possibly never to return. They don't do it for fun. They do it out of desperation.
We asked Mr. Corbyn about the new Borders and Nationality Bill, which is being described as the most racist legislation in decades and could harm those seeking asylum in the UK.
Oppose the Borders and Nationality Bill. It's brutal, it's unnecessary, and it's demonising people who are desperate. Nobody gets into a boat to cross the English Channel unless they're really desperate. They are desperate people who end up on the shores of this country. They should be supported, they should be housed, they should be welcomed, because they're people fleeing from poverty, from oppression, and from environmental degradation.
The former Labour leader, who represents a growing number of British citizens and politicians that support the Palestinian cause, has been a figurehead of the resistance for decades, bringing hope to young Palestinians who dream of returning to their homeland. Yanka Rahimi, London.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.